Friends, on behalf of the organizers of Strings 2001, I'd like to welcome you for this special lecture program. Strings 2001 was an international conference that just concluded a few hours ago here at the Tata Institute. It involved many very distinguished speakers and participants from all over the world who were discussing very, very technical issues about string theory. I'm not going to tell you what it is all about because this program is about that. But we thought that perhaps it is a good idea to share with you the non-specialists the great intellectual excitement of this subject. So in this program, we feature three very distinguished scientists: Professor David Gross, Edward Witten, and Stephen Hawking. And this program is a joint event of the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research and the Clay Mathematics Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who are also the two of the several co-organizers of Strings 2001. I take this opportunity to thank the Sarojini Damodaran International Fellowship Program of the TIFR and the Clay Mathematics Institute for the financial support that has made this event possible. It is befitting for me to say a few words about these two institutions before we begin this event. As you all must be knowing, the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research was founded in 1945 by Dr. Homi Bhabha with the help of the Sir Dorabji Tata Trust, and later acquired its present status as a national center of the Government of India. TIFR has since grown into a world-class center for theoretical and experimental research in a wide range of disciplines spanning physics, mathematics, chemistry, biology, and computer science. The institute has sophisticated experimental and computational facilities and a comprehensive graduate training program for PhD students. In addition to the main campuses in Mumbai, TIFR has several centers at different locations from India. The presence of this institute is, in a sense, a tribute to the visions of its founding fathers, namely Dr. Homi Bhabha, Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, and Mr. G.R.D. Tata. The Clay Mathematics Institute is a private non-profit foundation dedicated to increase and disseminate mathematical knowledge. The formation of CMI grew from the vision of Boston businessman London T. Clay. Mathematics embodies the quintessence of human knowledge. Mathematics reaches into every field of human endeavor, and the frontiers of mathematical understanding evolve today in deep and unfathomable ways. Fundamental advances in mathematical knowledge go hand in hand with discoveries in all fields of science. Technological applications of mathematics underpin our daily life, including our ability to communicate and to travel, our health and well-being, our security, and our global prosperity. The evolution of mathematics today will remain a central ingredient in shaping our world tomorrow. To appreciate the scope of mathematical truth challenges the capabilities of the human mind. This is the vision statement of the Clay Mathematics Institute. CMI attempts to further the beauty, the power, and the universality of mathematical thought. To this end, CMI currently pursues several programs, and it has also instituted several prizes called the Millennium Prizes. It's $1 million a prize for the solution of some outstanding mathematics problems. And at least one of them I could recognize as an outstanding physics problem. The scientific advisory board of CMI consists of Alan Cohn, Arthur Jaffe, Andrew Wiles, and Edward Witten. And I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Edward Witten for the support he has extended in bringing this event about. I'd also like to thank Arthur Jaffe for agreeing to be a co-organizer, for Clay Mathematics Institute to be a co-organizer of this meeting. With these few words, I conclude. I forgot to do something in the beginning, so let me just end with that. My name is Venta Wadia, and I work at the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research. Thank you.
Okay, let me begin by saying that my name is Atish Davolkar, and I work at the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research. The first speaker today is Professor David Gross from the Institute for Theoretical Physics, Santa Barbara. I would like to invite Professor David Gross onto the stage. David Gross has been one of the leaders in string theory and more broadly in theoretical particle physics. He is one of the chief architects of the fundamental theory of the strong nuclear force. This theory, called quantum chromodynamics, now provides the basis for understanding the properties of strongly interacting particles like protons and neutrons and all of nuclear physics. After tackling the difficult problems of strong interactions, David turned his attention to easier problems like the theory of all interactions. He is one of the discoverers of the heterotic string theory, a version of string theory which was seen to have the potential to incorporate all observed elementary particles and their interactions in a unified framework. He led a great school in theoretical particle physics for over two decades at Princeton University before moving to the Institute of Theoretical Physics at Santa Barbara, where he is currently the director. He is the recipient of numerous awards and medals, including the Oscar Klein Medal and the Dirac Medal. I would like to say that David is a brilliant expositor and an inspiring teacher. I had the opportunity to learn quantum field theory and particle physics from him, and he was one of my heroes. And I remember that at the end of these courses, the students were really dazzled by his awesome lectures. So today we can look forward to an awesome lecture on Towards the Theory of Everything by David Gross.
Well, thank you, Atish. Can you hear me in the back? Before I start, let me just tell this audience what a wonderful conference we've just had here in Mumbai. And I think you should all, as citizens of Mumbai and of India, be very proud of the Tata Institute and of its string theorists. (Clears throat) So the title of my talk is Towards a Theory of Everything. Sometimes I add a question mark at the end, but I haven't today. I am going to, of course, discuss string theory. String theory is something I'm sure if you've been reading the Mombay papers in the last few days has attracted a lot of attention, not just among scientists around the world, but also in the general public. This is true in the United States as well. It became evident to me a year or two ago when I opened the New Yorker magazine, which I'm sure many of you know. It's a magazine full of exciting articles and cartoons. And I saw this cartoon, which depicts two intellectuals walking in a Greenwich Village, probably. You can tell they're intellectuals because she has long hair and he has no hair. And she's saying, it's all string theory to me. Well, I was delighted to see that string theory has replaced Greek as one of the most hard to understand things to an American intellectual. But of course, this is our motto. It's all string theory to us. And I want to give you an idea of why we have been led to this very strange theory, which replaces particles by strings, tells us that we have at least six more spatial dimensions than we see around us, and purports to be a theory of everything. Now, that's a tall order in the short amount of time that I have. So I'm going to start by giving you a bit of background. Namely, I'll briefly tell you what we do know for sure. Namely, I'll discuss the state of elementary particle physics, that branch of physics that studies the elementary particles. Of course, they're really strings, but the moment we see them as particles that make up matter and the forces between them, this effort that has been going on for much of the last century has culminated in a very comprehensive theory of all the particles and forces that we have observed to date. But then I'll also explain many of the things that we don't know, and attempts to go beyond this theory. The theory is called the standard model, really should be called the standard theory. And I'll discuss some of the wonderful issues that that theory begs us to answer, some of the wonderful questions we're now facing, and why we're led to such an ambitious attempt as string theory, whose structure I'll briefly describe, and I'll focus at the end on three possible conceptual revolutions that we might be in the middle of carrying out. So let me start with describing what we do know. And in this cartoon, I picture the exploration that we've been undertaking in the last century as an exploration that goes up the mountain of energy. We are forced to increase the energy of our microscopes in order to pierce matter at shorter and shorter distances. And so much of the exploration in particle physics requires enormous accelerators, very powerful microscopes. And with the aid of these powerful microscopes, particle accelerators, over the last 50 years, we've made enormous progress in deciphering the fundamental constituents of matter and figuring out how they interact, the forces of nature. Starting in the earlier part of the century with the development of quantum mechanics, which elucidated the structure of atoms and ordinary solids, in the last half of the 20th century, we deduced both the elementary constituents of matter, which we now see as quarks that make up the proton and the neutron, all the nuclei of all the atoms around us, as well as leptons, primary example of which is the electron, which constitutes the other particle in ordinary atoms. And we've also identified the forces of nature, the forces that bind quarks within nuclei. That's the strong nuclear force, which is explained by a theory called quantum chromodynamics that Atish alluded to, as well as the more traditional electromagnetic forces, which have been unified together with the so-called weak force. That is the force that is responsible for radioactivity. These three or two forces and a few quarks and leptons are the stuff from which the standard model has been constructed. And this theory has been extraordinarily successful in explaining just about everything that we have observed with microscopes that penetrate to distances down to a millionth of a millionth of a millionth of a centimeter. For the last 25 years, particle experimentalists have been looking for new physics and testing this theory, and so far they haven't found any new physics, and they haven't found anything wrong with this theory, and you might think that this is a theory of everything. After all, it's a theory more or less of everything that we can observe at the moment. However, as I will try to explain, we know for sure that it isn't a theory of everything. Aside from leaving out gravity, it also does not answer many questions that must be answered. And so our goal, as always, is to probe to shorter and shorter distances, higher and higher energies, where we have every reason to believe, and many hints that new physics will emerge, new structure. And we expect many surprises and anticipated discoveries in the next few years with new machines that are being built at CERN and in the United States. And far above, at the top of the mountain, perhaps, or at least a nice way station to the top, sit string theory and quantum gravity, which we'll get to. Now, one of the fundamental parts of the theory that we now possess is our understanding of what makes up ordinary matter, what makes up the atoms from which we're all made and everything around us. And the guiding principle in figuring out what are the constituents of matter remarkably was stated by Democritus 2,400 years ago, who and at that time scientists expressed themselves in verse. They've lost that ability today, unfortunately. Democritus said, "By convention there is color, by convention, sweetness, by convention, bitterness. But in reality, there are atoms and space." And that summarizes very well one of the main lessons of the last 2.5 millennium. And our theory of physics and chemistry, and indeed of all physical phenomena so far, is based on the idea that there are point-like elementary objects with well-defined laws of force between them, in between space, and all physical phenomena are a consequence of that structure. Now, Democritus really was a dreamer at that time, but over the centuries, we've been exploring that idea and showing that at each level, there is a deeper substructure of matter. So that indeed a flower, which has color and sweetness, is made up out of point-like atoms. But the point-like atoms that were thought to make up ordinary matter were revealed in the beginning of this century to have a structure. Inside the atom, there was a point-like nucleus and point-like electrons. The first example of the family of leptons surrounding the nucleus. And later in the 20th century, the nucleus was shown to have structure. One needed, of course, more powerful microscopes, the particle accelerators, to see that the nucleus was not a point, but rather looked like a conglomerate, a collection of other elementary particles, point-like protons and neutrons that make up the nuclei of ordinary atoms. And later, as I was in graduate school, it was discovered that the nucleons themselves are not point-like, but look very much as if they're made out of another, more elementary kind of particle called quarks. Quarks, so far, like the leptons, the electrons, appear to us to be point-like. We haven't seen any substructure, and they are the fundamental building blocks. The quarks are bound permanently inside nucleons, make up the nuclei of the atoms, and Democritus was right, at least until now. Now, nature is a little wasteful. It repeats this pattern of quarks and electrons three times, and we believe that all we need to describe all the phenomena that we have ever seen so far are three families of the kinds of leptons and quarks that make up ordinary atoms. So this is it, the list of matter. We have no deep reason to understand where this matter comes from, but we have figured out the pattern. We have no deep understanding of the masses and some of the couplings of these particles, but with a few such numbers that we take from measurement, and with a deep understanding of the forces between these particles based on profound and beautiful principles of symmetry, we have constructed this theory, the standard model of particle physics. It is based on quantum mechanics and relativity, on essentially the idea of Democritus that the basic constituents of matter are point-like, local, and their interactions occur at points. Quantum field theory, as a description of the standard model, in a sense, is the most fundamental, experimentally proven language that we have for describing the universe. And as exemplified in the standard model, it is the theory of all the observed forces of nature as seen to date. And it has been tested to extremely high accuracy, down to distances of 10 to the minus 18, a millionth of a millionth of a millionth of a centimeter, with accuracies that, in the case of quantum electrodynamics, the quantum theory of electricity and magnetism, are unprecedented in the history of science. In some cases, better than one part in a billion, the predictions of the theory and the experimental measurements. In the case of the more modern components of the standard model, the electroweak and theory in QCD, the agreement is excellent, sometimes to one part in 10 to the 5, some part, in the case of QCD, one part in 1,000. And as I said, so far we have observed almost nothing that does not fit into this picture. We have no reason to believe that this theory breaks down until perhaps we get to incredibly small distances. This distance scale, called the Planck length, will occur again, and I'll explain why it is fundamental. But until we get there, there is nothing in the theory that signals its demise. And because the theory describes in its classical, non-relativistic limit phenomena that occur at the size of galaxies, indeed, if we incorporate quantum, the field theory of general relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity within it, it describes the structure, the grand structure of the universe. We might very well say that quantum field theory works from the Planck length to the edge of the universe. And that's 60 orders of magnitude. There surely has been no theory so successful in the history of physics. And yet, we don't call this a theory of everything. Why not? Well, scientific progress occurs schematically in the following way. Usually what happens in science is that a lucky experimenter will stumble on a new phenomena and will ask the question, what is that? Rentgen, for example, discovered X-rays almost accidentally. And if he was asking one question, it surely was, what? And physicists then explore experimentally the new phenomena, but at some stage, when they begin to understand what it is they're looking at, they want to understand how it works. That's the difference between physics and botany. And that's a collaboration of experimenters and theorists. The theorists try to construct mathematical models, theoretical descriptions of the phenomena, and make predictions which the experimenters test. And this is a collaborative effort that goes on until we understand how the phenomena work. And in the case of the Standard Model, we've more or less completed this how stage. We do understand how the electricity and magnetism and radioactivity and the nuclear force work. And we can calculate their properties and make predictions that work. But the story doesn't end there. There's another question which children and physicists ask, which is why? And once we have understood how things work, then the why questions come to the forefront, many of which could not be asked even before we understood what we're talking about and how it works. And this is often a more lonely pursuit of theorists who extrapolate their theories, push them to extremes, look for theoretical problems that would hint that something is wrong with the theory, or ask simply why questions, for which they need more powerful theories to answer. And often this suggests new experiments, and the cycle closes, and we go on. Well, we're now in elementary particle physics, in the search for the fundamental laws of physics, at this stage. And string theory is certainly at this stage, where it's mostly a theoretical enterprise. So I want to state this succinctly. The most important product of knowledge is ignorance. The development of science develops knowledge which allows us to be ignorant in an informed way. The questions that are coming to that we're asking today are questions that were not and could not have been asked 25 years ago, when our knowledge was not sufficient for us to be ignorant. Well, what are these questions that we ask? There are so many that I cannot describe them all. I'll just give you a feeling for the kinds of questions. Some of them have to do with the forces of nature. As I said, the forces of nature that we've identified are all consequence of beautiful symmetry principles that tell us that the laws of nature are unchanged when we make certain transformations on the world. It's a beautiful principle, it has beautiful mathematics, but we don't understand in a deep way why the forces are of this form and not of any other form. We can imagine, indeed, many other kinds of forces that we've never seen. And there are all these parameters that characterize the strength of these forces. For example, the electromagnetic, the force of electricity, the strength of that force is measured in dimensional units by a famous constant of nature called the fine structure constant, which is 1 over 137.02 dot, dot, dot. And that number we cannot explain, so we take it from experiment. But it's an intriguing number, and we would love to calculate that number. Surely there's a reason why that number is what it is. And then there's this strange pattern of matter, these three families of quarks and leptons with a very bizarre pattern of masses. For example, the top quark, which is the last quark recently discovered at Fermilab, though everyone knew it was there, but they finally observed it and measured its mass, and it turns out to be 100,000 times more massive than the quarks that make up us. That's why it was took so long to produce it. This one quark, this little quark, weighs as much as a gold atom. So there's a very strange pattern of masses and other properties of these basic particles that we cannot explain. They look very mysterious. Surely our theory should do that. These phenomena, these problems, these questions cannot be answered by the framework that we have. There have been many attempts, but we really believe that they cannot be answered by the present framework. And finally, we're beginning to ask other profound questions. As you'll see, gravity, the dynamics of space-time, is beginning to play a fundamental role in our investigations. And so we begin to ask questions that heretofore were thought to be metaphysical, such as, why does space have only 10 dimensions? I mean, 3. Why? Now, the answer to these questions is important. It's important for the same reason that it's important to answer your children's why questions, because curiosity is one of the primary human features. And we should all strive to answer our curiosity. But from a scientific point of view, it's important for other fields of science as well. For example, to understand the beginning of the universe, we have to understand physics at the very high energy scales which we're driven to answer these questions. Because the universe went through stages in its evolution where we believe that a theory that lies beyond our present theory was operative. And if we're ever to understand the origin of the universe, we'll have to understand physics at that stage. Now, Einstein expressed a principle very well years ago, which really explains why we believe that given such questions, there has to be a more fundamental theory. He said that nature is constituted so that it is possible to lay down such strong, determined laws that within these laws, only completely determined constants occur, not constants that could be changed without completely destroying the theory. It's a very strong point of view, and it's one that many of us share. A theory like the Standard Model, which has a parameter like this and doesn't explain what it is, and would be perfectly happy if the parameter alpha was not 1 over 137.02, but 1 over 137.01, nothing much would happen, neither to the theory nor to the world, if we changed alpha by an eensy-beensy bit. Einstein would not accept that. He would say that if you change that number in the correct theory, the adequate theory, then the theory would be completely destroyed. In other words, in our description of nature, there should be no free parameters, no arbitrariness, and if there is, that's a sign that you haven't finished your job. So all of these questions must have answers, we believe, and where can we find them? We have very few experimental clues, although we do have some. So theorists, in order to go beyond the Standard Model, the first thing they do is extrapolate their knowledge to see if there are any signs of ignorance buried in that knowledge, to see whether the theory breaks down. And where it traditionally breaks down is if you look at shorter distances and discover that atoms are made out of electrons and nuclei and so on. You look at shorter and shorter distances to discover an underlying structure, a new level. And usually, so far, we found in doing that more beautiful, more comprehensive, more unified, more predictive theories. So since the beginning of the Standard Model, which described the strong nuclear, the electromagnetic, and the weak force, were understood in the middle of the 70s, people have been extrapolating that theory in energy to high energies, where one would like to do directly experiments, but one cannot. This is an energy scale running in electron volts. We now are more or less confined experimentally to this regime. We would like to go farther, but it's very expensive. And the easiest thing to extrapolate in the theory, the component of the theory that we understand the best, is the theory of the forces of nature, based on the symmetries, the gauge principle. And so we extrapolate those forces, and we discover that the nuclear force gets weaker as one goes to higher energies. It depends on the scale. It changes as one goes to shorter and shorter distances. It gets weaker, whereas the electromagnetic force gets stronger. And from the beginning of the Standard Model, there was an indication that these forces all came together. And indeed, they look like they fit together mathematically as well at an enormously high energy scale. Not only that, that scale was not too far from where gravity becomes important. Now, you might think gravity is an important force. In fact, it's the only force you readily recognize in daily life. Things fall. But that's only because things are made out of enormous numbers of atoms. The gravitational force within an atom is 40 orders of magnitude less than the electric force. However, gravity is a force that obviously gets stronger with higher energy. And for that, you only need to know one formula that you all know, and that's E, energy equals mc squared, equals mass, times the velocity of light squared. Because gravity, of course, is the force that couples to mass. It's a force that pulls a mass with a force that's proportional to that mass. But mass is energy. Gravity really attracts energy. And as you increase the energy, gravity gets stronger, like the square of the energy. So a very small force here can become big here, comparable to the other forces. And by extrapolating what we know about gravity and the other forces, they all come together at what is called the Planck scale that I referred to before. It's incredibly high energy, which probes distances of order 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. This picture suggests, and this picture in the last 25 years, because of very nice experiments, has gotten better and better and better, so that it suggests that nothing really crucial happens here. We actually expect many interesting surprises and new discoveries, a whole new wonderful world of, it's called the super world, in which a new symmetry called supersymmetry manifests itself, which I unfortunately do not have time to tell you about. But at a more really fundamental level, nothing perhaps happens until you get to this new scale, far away from where we can measure, where all the forces and gravity become equally important and perhaps are unified. Well, what is this Planck scale? Why is it the fundamental scale of physics? Well, in physics, we measure things, and we use units in which we measure things. We measure distance. We measure time, which is going very fast. And we measure mass. And actually, anything else we measure can be expressed in terms of units of length, time, and mass. And there are three constants in nature that play a fundamental role, we believe. The velocity of light, the quantum of action, the gravitational constant. And Planck, who was the last to discover, Planck, who discovered the last of these dimensionful constants, the quantum of action, was very excited about this discovery. In his second paper on quantum mechanics, devoted a whole section to laying forward a system of units, which he said he would use, or we should use, to communicate with beings on Sirius. If beings on another galaxy were to ask us how big we were, well, we would use the Planck length and say, well, we're 10 to the 35 basic units big. And they would understand, because these are the most fundamental units we can construct out of the most fundamental parameters. And the remarkable thing is that they're so small, such small distances, such short time, such high energies. That in physics is called the hierarchy problem. It's the problem that the Planck scale is so much larger than the scale, even the subatomic scale of quarks and leptons. And for theorists, that's a big problem, because we're going to have to extrapolate, we believe, to that scale by 19 orders of magnitude. Well, as I said, that's the scale where quantum gravity becomes important. So if we have to, where gravity becomes a strong force, and where the quantum effects of gravity are important. And so we have to cope with quantum gravity if we're going to unify at that scale. And the most glaring limitation of our present theory, of this quantum field theory, is its apparent inability to incorporate gravity. Gravity, according to Einstein, is the dynamics of space and time, which are no longer inert, as they were before Einstein, but dynamical and fluctuate and change. If you put a mass into space, it warps it. That's what causes planetary motion and black holes. But the quantum fluctuations of space and time seem to be uncontrollable at the Planck length within this so successful theory of all the other forces. And although people have tried within the quantum field theory framework for decades to construct a consistent theory, they have failed. And most particle physicists, when they contemplated this situation, conjectured that therefore Einstein's theory is only an effective theory, like many other examples in the history of physics, like Maxwell's theory, for example, replaced by quantum electrodynamics, that Einstein's theory is only valid for large distances compared to the Planck length, and that when one gets to the regime of the Planck length, where gravity becomes strong, the theory breaks down and should really be replaced by a better theory that reduces to Einstein's theory only for large distances. This theory, we believe, cannot be quantum field theory. And that's one of the strongest reasons, conceptually, that we have to go beyond quantum field theory, aside from the fact that quantum field theory probably can't answer most of those why questions that we're faced with, to string theory. So what is string theory? Well, string theory is finally a break with Democritus. So I said, Democritus for 2.5 millennia has been pretty successful. We've gone from atoms to nuclei to protons to quarks and electrons. And string theory says, no more. You're not going to look inside an electron and a quark and discover subleptons and subquarks and so on and so on. It ends here. If you look inside a quark, or you look at a quark, an electron and a photon, light ray, or the quanta of gravity, any particle that we've identified, either a particle constituent of matter or a quanta of force, you will discover that all of these elementary particles have a structure. In fact, they look like this. Doesn't work. They are strings. They're extended one-dimensional objects, closed, perhaps open. Their size might be very small. Naively, at least, it should be of order the Planck length. That's why we can't see this structure directly. And we have the great advantage that if there is an extended object like this, it has much more structure than a point-like object. A point-like object has no internal structure. It's an atom. It might have a few labels or colors or spin. It might spin, but a string is much richer. A string can vibrate, can have many different configurations. It can vibrate with different notes. And each vibration of the string will manifest itself to us in string theory as one of these point-like elementary particles. So from the beginning, because the theory is based on these extended objects with structure, it is conceivable that you could unify all the particles we've ever seen as different modes of vibration of a single object, the string. That's not exactly how we arrived at string theory, but it's clearly one of its advantages. So let me say a word about string theory. It's very hard to modify the principles of physics. There are a lot of people who do it. I get letters and now emails from people, two or three every week, with some new theory. But it's usually easy to see that these are wrong, inconsistent with observation or with logic. It's very difficult, almost impossible, to really change the laws of physics. And if you're going to do so, you should be as conservative as possible. But of course, if you want to make progress, you have to do something radical as well. So you should do something, but not too much. And in the case of string theory, at least so far, really all we've done is replace particles by strings, keeping all the other principles of physics unchanged. We haven't messed up with quantum mechanics or with the general symmetry principles of relativity and so on. We've tried to keep everything else unchanged, to be conservative, and only make this seemingly harmless replacement of point-like particles with extended strings. And the advantage of making a small change in the laws of physics is that you can then use all the other laws to tell you what to do. So if you want to describe particles, we usually discuss the motion of a particle. There's a particle moving in time, saying that it maps out a trajectory. Classical physics, we simply calculate the motion of a particle by minimizing the world, the length of this world line that describes the motion of the particle through space as time evolves. And it is rather straightforward, conceptually trivial, mathematically slightly complicated, to generalize that notion to strings. You simply say that a string moves in space and sweeps out a world tube instead of a world line. You minimize to calculate the trajectory, not the length of the line, but the obvious generalization going from points to circles, the area of the tube. And that, in fact, is the way you discuss classical motion of strings. So aside from replacing particles by strings, you haven't done anything conceptually to the theory. And it's absolutely straightforward. And given these pictures, there's a well-defined way of constructing quantum mechanical probabilities for such a motion that was described by Feynman. You sum over all such paths, lines here, tubes here. And that tells you how to construct the quantum theory of strings. And that's what people did. And if you want to describe not just one string moving all by itself, but interacting strings with forces between them, in the case of particles, we do that by these same pictures, where we describe an electron scattering, interacting with a proton by exchanging other particles. And associated with these pictures of particles emitting, shooting off other particles. This is a photon, a quanta of light, which hits the proton, and that's how they interact. These pictures can be translated into definite probabilities for events, scattering events. And we can just, we have followed the same logic in describing strings, except that strings now, as they move, sweep out these tubes and they emit other strings, which are absorbed by the other string, and following the same rules by associating with these diagrams certain phases, amplitudes, one can, using these pictures and a little more complicated mathematics, construct a theory of quantized strings. Except there's a profound difference that occurred at this point in the development of string theory, and it has to do with the nature of the string interaction. When particles turn into other particles, what happened? So here's particle A, the A has disappeared, hits particle B, they come together at the same point, at the same time, they can turn into particle C. That's an elementary particle interaction. An electron, positron annihilate to form a photon. And in this picture describing their decay, there's a very special point called the interaction point. And that's where all the arbitrariness of quantum field theory comes about. This point is where you have to specify what the probability that these particles, this one and this one, will annihilate. Well, in string theory, we do exactly the same thing. We have two strings, which should be luminescent, but they're not. And they come together as they move in time. A has disappeared again, and B, and they form particle C. And this diagram here, like this one, is what's responsible, could be regarded as what's responsible for string interactions. And it's called the pants diagram because it has the topology of your pants. So if you take slices through your pants, you get a string. And so as time moves, you take slices and you end up at your belt with one string. Two strings have turned into one string. Now there's a profound difference between these two diagrams. This one has a very special point. That's where the interaction occurs. That's where you have to put in the fine structure constant and all the arbitrariness of quantum field theory. But in the pants diagram, if you have well-tailored pants, there's no special point. An ant walking on your pants doesn't know where the interaction took place. In fact, the ant only knows that an interaction takes place if he looks at this whole picture. And he sees that down here there were two strings, two legs, and up here there was only one. And in some way, this is one of the ways of seeing that in string theory, unlike particle theories, unlike quantum field theory, the interaction, the string interaction, is unique, is topological. Once you know how free strings move, you know how they interact. And indeed, that seems to be the case. In string theory, following Einstein's dictum, there does not seem to be any of the arbitrariness of quantum field theories. Any room for free parameters that can be adjusted. String theory, therefore, has the potential of being extraordinarily predictive, of allowing you to calculate all parameters. Now, we're so far from that that it's hard for, I don't want to go on too much in that line. We, our understanding of the theory is so meager that our, with our present control over the theory, we seem to have lots of possibilities, not just one unique description of the world. But we know no reason why that's not just a consequence of our meager theoretical tools. We see no reason why there should be in string theory any parameter that has to be taken from nature and not calculable. It's a remarkable theory, and that's why it's sometimes called, one of the reasons it's been called a theory of everything. Well, what has string theory achieved to date? Well, its most important achievement, really, is the fact that it is a consistent change in the conceptual framework of physics. That, as I said, is not trivial, and it has passed all tests. There's nothing inconsistent about it that we've found, so that's quite remarkable and very rare. But many of us believe that it's more than that. It really is the beginning of a revolution in physics, probably comparable to the two other revolutions that occurred in the last century. Those had to do with understanding the physics that pertains when velocities are close to the speed of light, relativity, and the even more profound change in physics where the action, where quantum effects, fluctuations become important. And they have, those revolutions are characterized by two of the dimensionful parameters of nature, the velocity of light and Planck's constant. But there's one more, Newton's constant, which really defines a length. And many of us believe that string theory is the revolution that we're in the middle of, which has to do with the Planck length. And that, like these other revolutions, it will force us to change in a very profound way our concepts of nature and to construct a new kind of theory that will reduce to ordinary quantum field theory at large distances, much like relativity. Einstein's theory goes over to Newton's theory for small velocities. But we're still in the middle of that revolution, as I'll remark on. And then, as I said a while back, string theory is strongly indicated because it is consistent with strong quantized gravity. It does provide an extension of Einstein's theory for large, small distances, which goes over to Einstein's theory for large distances, but it seems to be completely consistent with quantum mechanics. And that's very important. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, it provides us with a very rich structure that seems to contain all the elements we need to construct the standard model. Within string theory and some of its approximate solutions, we can find all the particles that make up the standard model and all the forces that we've ever discovered in nature. We see no reason why the theory couldn't work, and many hints that it does. But unfortunately, we're not smart enough so far to solve the theory, predict its behavior at the low energies that we're constrained to observe at. So I'm not going to discuss too much this aspect, but I do want to say a word or two about the first two points. String theory certainly proves that quantum mechanics and general relativity are consistent. And this was a worry for many years. Many people, frustrated by the inability to marry quantum mechanics and relativity, believed that we would have to modify quantum mechanics, or something even worse, in order to reconcile these two. But at least for weak gravitational fields, we have a completely consistent theory of quantum gravity where we can do calculations of quantum gravitational effects, which used to be infinite and therefore uninteresting, and now are very small effects and therefore uninteresting, but at least something close to zero is a little more satisfactory to the soul than something infinite. More interesting, string theory has now provided us with the tools to explore paradoxical issues that arise for strong gravity, where the effects are not insignificant, and in particular, black holes. As well, we hope, questions such as the origin of the universe. In the case of black holes, one has run into a very paradoxical situation, especially since the work of Hawking almost 30 years ago, one that seems to be explained by string theory. So far, string theory has only explained a small part of the mysteries of black holes, but most of us believe it will account for the other mysteries in due course. And finally, string theory suggests that although we, in the beginning, only modified the nature of the elementary constituents of matter that we're going to have to change our notions of space and time. Now, we certainly are going to have to change our notion of space and time in one way, which I alluded to, that there are more dimensions to space. This is an old idea going back to Einstein. Once Einstein told us that space and time were dynamical, physicists began to imagine extra curled up spatial dimensions that wouldn't be observable, because unlike a sheet of paper, they wouldn't extend in both directions, but they'd be curled up in one direction, and therefore hard to see. If this direction is very small, like the Planck length, you would need a very good microscope to see the extra dimension with a resolving power that we don't have. So the fact that string theory tells us, remarkably, that there are at least 9 spatial dimensions, or perhaps 10, is not in contradiction with observation if these dimensions are curled up. Now, I once did a little study as to who first discussed this possibility of extra dimensions, and remarkably, Ernest Mach, the Viennese physicist philosopher, in 1883 wrote in the Science of Mechanics that spaces of more than 3 dimensions may be used, but he didn't really believe in them. It's not necessary to regard these as... But, you know, Mach, this was 25 years before Einstein's theory of special relativity, not to speak of general relativity and Kaluza-Klein, and I was very surprised to find this. There was a little footnote, and it remarked that in the Café Society of Vienna, a very civilized place, it seems, people were sitting around in cafes and talking about Bernard Riemann, the German mathematician's recent work on n-dimensional geometries, and were fascinated by spaces with more than 3 dimensions. And as Mach said especially, the use of the 4th dimension was a very opportune discovery for the spiritualists and the theologians who were in a quandary about the location of hell. I mean, since Galileo, they'd been looking in telescopes and couldn't find it. What better place to... So I wonder what they'll do with the 6 extra dimensions that we talk about. I can think of some people we could put there. In the last few years, a fantastic idea has been put forward by some string theorists and their phenomenological colleagues, that some of these new dimensions might not be so big, and they might not be so small. In fact, they could even be, in a sense, infinite. And the reason we don't observe them is that we're trapped in a mere 3-dimensional world. We're trapped, as we say, on the brain. We're trapped on the wall of this room. And the quarks and gluons, electrons and protons, all the stuff that we're made out of can't escape the brain. But there is space out there, and space fluctuates, and the fluctuation of space is gravity, so gravity will exist out there in the room. And so that's not totally metaphysical to say that, you know, we're stuck on the wall. There is an outside there, and much physics. And in such a world, it appears that our preconceptions about how big the extra dimensions could be, or how far off the scale of gravity might be altered. And although these are very speculative, these speculations appear both to be consistent with current experimental evidence, and they certainly predict an enormous number of dramatic effects that could be discovered at the next machine we build. This possibility, which I regard as very unlikely, would, however, could give dramatic confirmation of many of the ideas that we're playing with. But our knowledge of string theory is very much like the knowledge of the elephant with the blind men feeling its various features. We don't have a comprehensive picture of the whole theory by far. And I like to picture the state of string theory at this moment in time as very similar in nature to the state of quantum theory, which was the big revolution of the 20th century, before 1925, when quantum mechanics was discovered. There was a long period pioneered by Planck and Einstein and others in which experimental observation played a crucial role. And then the Bohr model came along, Bohr's theory of the atom, which was a rather ad hoc approach to atomic theory based on assumptions that didn't make sense in classical physics. And then it took about 12 years of exploration of this so-called old quantum theory to discover quantum mechanics, which is the framework we now work with. And in this time, experiment actually played very little role. There were important experiments going on, but if you had taken Arnold Sommerfeld's students and put them on an island in 1913, they would have come up with quantum mechanics because they had enough of the theory that by theoretical exploration of its properties and everything else they knew would have led them to quantum mechanics, as it did. And we're sort of in the same situation in string theory, where we have what I think is the old string theory, except we're not sure what to put here, and we're not sure what to call it, or what it is. But it might very well involve severe changes in the way we think about the fundamental principles of physics. In particular, the nature of space-time, as I have alluded to, and perhaps the initial conditions of the universe, and something I call the unity of kinematics and dynamics. And so let me just say a word about these conceptual revolutions that we might be forced to make to finalize string theory. In a recent newspaper article, some of us were quoted. I'm not sure Ed will appreciate this, but he said, space and time may be doomed. And Nadi Seiberg said, I am almost certain that space and time are illusions. Andy Strominger, who's a distinguished string theorist, said, the notion of space-time is clearly something we're going to have to give up. And I said, the real change that's around the corner is the way we think about space-time. We haven't come to grips with what Einstein taught us, but it's coming, and it'll make the world very strange. So this is a pretty unanimous feeling. And what is it based on? Why is space-time doomed? Well, there are a variety of reasons, but I'll give you just a few of them. In string theory, for example, we can change the number of spatial dimensions or the way the theory looks by changing what appears to be a coupling. It's as if we take electrodynamics and make that fine structure constant bigger, and suddenly we no longer have three dimensions, we have four. That's pretty bizarre. Even stranger, we can tear string theory can continuously tear the fabric of space. What does that mean? Well, in string theory, as I said, we describe these extended objects, these strings, moving in space. And so we can start out with a situation in which some of the dimensions of space are curled up into a small little region, and strings look like they're moving in this background space. And then by changing the parameters continuously of the solution, we go into a region where this normal picture of strings moving in some ordinary spatial space isn't valid. We keep on going, we get to another region where it is valid, but the space has changed, and in a dramatic way. Its topology has changed. We've ripped, going from here to here, in classical terms, you have to rip the fabric of space and put it together in a different way, and that is a singular thing you cannot do in classical quantum field theories. String theory has no problem. This is a nice continuous transition. String theory, we can't probe arbitrarily small distances. To do so, we would have to use string microscopes. Now, in ordinary quantum mechanics, there is something called the uncertainty principle. You need very high energy, as I said, to probe short distances, because you need very high frequency or small wavelength light. So the usual way of getting to very small distances is to make the energy very big, and therefore your resolution very small. But in string theory, if you pump energy into a string, it grows. And so you get another contribution to the uncertainty or to the resolution, which grows with energy. And there's sort of a minimal length that you can explore using stringy microscopes, which, not surprisingly, is the Planck length. So somehow it doesn't make any sense. You could never observe smaller distances than the Planck length, and maybe the notion of distance doesn't make any sense at such small distances. If you try to push down to short distances in other ways by, say, taking some compactified circle, one of those straws, and squeezing it to make it zero size, you discover that it sort of grows out. The theory of one radius, very small, say, is totally equivalent, no difference than the theory with a big radius. And this is the description we would use. And where this one goes over to this one is, again, the Planck length. It turns out that whenever we squeeze string theory and try to get to point-like structure or singularities where bad things happen in classical and in quantum field theories, string theory avoids this by moving out again into a different dual description, but one that is perfectly okay. So to paraphrase Democritus, we have hints that space-time can be replaced, in fact, in string theory, by other degrees of freedom, by other elements of nature, and is an emergent approximate concept. We have other ways of holographically representing it. So to paraphrase Democritus, we're convinced that by convention there is space, and by convention there is time, but in reality there, and we don't know how to finish the verse, unfortunately. And that's what we're faced, one of the problems that we're faced with, how to finish this verse, how to complete these revolutions. I'm running out of time, so I will just remark that the other revolution that we might want to achieve, or we might be forced to achieve in order to understand the solution of string theory, is to go beyond traditional physics, which doesn't predict the initial conditions, only the laws of physics. And you normally have to give some initial conditions, and then you make predictions. But in the case of space-time that describes the universe, this is really a dynamical issue that has been discussed by many people, by my colleague Hartle and Stephen Hawking. And in string theory, where singularities are inevitably avoided, many of us have faith that it will allow us to understand the principle that fixes the initial condition of the universe and predict its fate. Our traditional understanding of the universe is that when we extrapolate backwards, we find a singularity. We find the Big Bang, where the laws of physics break down. String theory abhors singularities and usually changes the rules of the game and answers such questions as, what was the beginning of the universe, or what happened before the beginning, to a dual or different description in which the answer is obvious in a different language. And we might not only be able to do this, we might be forced to do this in order to explain what our observable universe looks like. I think I'll skip the last issue here. And end by answering the question as to when string theory will live up to all of its promises. Well, I used to answer this question a few years ago, by saying that it would happen in the next millennium. But now I can be much more optimistic, especially after such a wonderful conference. I can tell you with assurance that it'll be in this millennium. Thank you.
We have time for a couple of brief questions. Any questions?
Well, there. You see, yesterday I bought at the on the streets some strings. Unfortunately, these were cheap strings, so they ran out of juice because I was going to use them. So, in string theory, we have closed strings, and we have open strings. And if you'd asked me, string theory is an evolving thing. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have said they're closed because they're only closed strings. It's much more beautiful. Now we know that open strings play an equally fundamental role. And indeed, there are theories which we thought were different theories, open string theories, closed string theories. And now we understand that there's only one theory. And so there are both open strings and closed strings and many other interesting objects in string theory, in fact.
May I compliment you, David, for an admirable effort of you and your colleagues giving a framework for unifying forces of nature. You will admit that all good theories should be falsifiable. Of course, you could ask me the question why, in the spirit in which you've been presenting your talk. Can you offer any observational signature from nature which you think astronomers can look for? Closed loop strings, if they shrink and disappear, they'll pop off, give bursts of energy. Should we look for such energies, or are they all gone by now?
Well, again, this is an evolving story. Until a few years ago, I would have said that there was no hope. Nothing that we'd so far thought of which would have given us a very direct test of string physics. There are, of course, many indirect tests. There are many discoveries that could be made that would totally shake our faith overnight and could have been made at any time for the last 30 years. But as I remarked briefly, as our understanding of string theory has grown, so has the realm of possibilities about what nature looks like at an even modest increase in energy or going to shorter distances. And for an example of that, and there might be many others in different directions as we learn more about the theory, are these speculations about extra dimensions and the physics involved in that. If some of these speculations were true, then at the LHC, which is soon to be built at CERN, you would see direct evidence of strings, of strong gravitational effects. It would be evident. Now, I think that the chances are small because that's just the earliest we could make such observations. But that's progress, and I do not see any reason why there couldn't be other phenomena that we theorists are just too dumb to think of that are stringy in nature and that could be directly seen.
One last question.
So there is one theory called triple sun physics. Sir, there is one theory just we have come to know called triple sun physics. In those statements, I comes to know that space and time, exactly those are neither any matter nor force. These are just construct of the mind. And in general theory of relativity, which is totally based on space-time curvature, in the triple sun physics, it's stated the general theory of relativity is nothing but a philosophy and having no...
We'll take that question on tea time.
Pardon?
We don't have time. I think we are coming to the end of this. We don't have time.
I'll get out of there.
Good afternoon. I'm Sunil Mukhi, and I hope you're enjoying this program. I'd like to introduce you to the next speaker of the special lecture program, Professor Edward Witten from Caltech and the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. Edward. Professor Edward Witten has been called the torchbearer of string theory. He has made pioneering contributions to almost all the dominant themes in the subject over the past two decades, including supersymmetry, string compactifications, and duality. In his quest to discover the principles of string theory, he developed deep and beautiful connections between quantum field theory, string theory, and pure mathematics. He is a recipient of the Fields Medal for Mathematics, the closest analog of a Nobel Prize in that subject. And that's interesting because he isn't a mathematician, he's a physicist. In fact, he's the PhD student of David Gross, who just gave us a talk. I've had the privilege to introduce Edward once before, in the summer of 1983, when he was a speaker at the summer workshop of the International Center for Theoretical Physics in Trieste, Italy. Somewhat apologetically, he said he would like to talk about something called string theory at the end of his series of lectures. I did not realize then that this was to be a historic occasion. He proceeded to unravel the complexities of string theory, explaining why it could be the right quantum theory of gravity unified with the other forces in nature. I was dazzled by his insights and have continued to be dazzled by them ever since. Just over a year after that seminar, the so-called October Revolution in string theory took place in 1984, which propelled string theory into the spotlight. Edward moved directly to center stage in the field, a position he has occupied ever since. Edward Witten is a simple, modest, and kind person who enjoys interacting with youthful and inquiring minds. He believes that nothing is too complicated to try and explain, and he explains what he knows with clarity, generosity, and involvement. He expects of his audience only the sincere willingness to comprehend, and I'm sure the present audience will live up to this expectation. Thank you.
Well, thank you.